Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs, right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide, here in Tandunya, on the lands of Gunamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to Elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show,
we take an oath, and the first line of the oath is, I consecrate my life to the service of humanity. So how are we living under the oath if we are not doing something to address what is the greatest public health threat that we are all facing?
Intersections of health and climate are causing increasing concern. So we caught up with a panel of experts. Also, Brisbane's visibility is increasing as the 2032 Olympics approaches. Voices of multicultural Queenslanders are gaining more importance in international recognition. That's according to Queensland Minister for Multicultural Affairs. And later,
the biggest thing that we've realised in South Australia compared to any other place we've ever visited is just the amount of young people that are so concerned about the future of our planet, which has really been fueled by the algae bloom.
A new national youth wellbeing initiative is visiting schools to offer support for youth struggling with eco-anxiety amid South Australia's algae bloom catastrophe. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, Queensland has become the first state to ban pill testing in a contentious move advocates fear could lead to more harm than good. The state government has closed two pill testing facilities following new legislation passed last week. The decision is said to emphasise the government's zero-tolerance approach to illicit substances, which comes after the Liberal National Party ended $1.5 million of government funding to those two testing facilities earlier this year. An independent study completed by the University of Queensland, released around the same time the legislation came to play, found just over 50% of drugs contained what users expected, with the rest being spiked and deadly substances. To find out more about the ban of the pill testing stations in Queensland, Ella Panizzolo spoke with Rita Bryan, a researcher and harm reduction specialist working at the Pennington Institute.
So there's a wealth of evidence from around the world, really, to show that pill testing is an evidence-based strategy for reducing harm, as well as linking people in with other health and community services about their drug use. The evaluation of the Queensland Drug Checking Service was released last week, and we've also seen evaluations from services run in the ACT at festivals. And we know that from the Queensland data, only about 57% of the samples that people presented over the year contained only the expected substance that they thought was in the product. Certainly we know, you know, at least one in 10 people threw out their drugs based on the findings that they had from testing. One in five people, certainly in the Queensland data, said they'd reduce their substance use based on, you know, the information they'd received and the conversations they'd had with the healthcare workers.
How do pill testing services operate? And what happens when a dangerous substance is detected?
They're usually confidential services where somebody can bring in a sample to be tested, usually using quite technical chemistry equipment, which can provide information about what's in the substance that they've provided.
According to the ABC, in Canberra, a rare nitazine called isotocyanazine was discovered for the first time ever in a drug testing facility in Australia. What do you think this says about the importance of these facilities and their ability to help with harm reduction?
I think, again, you know, we have the most volatile and toxic unregulated drug supplier I think we've ever seen across the globe. Drug checking services provide an opportunity to analyse what's in the market right here, right now, which does mean that, you know, services like Cantest in the ACT and Checkpoint and in Queensland and now the Drug Checking Service in Victoria can provide critical, very timely information that not only is for the person who has presented the sample, but it provides an opportunity to inform public health and policy to be able to alert health services, hospitals, emergency services, who can prepare and respond more effectively to, contaminants and other things that are popping up in our markets.
As reported by The Guardian, earlier this month, the Queensland Deputy Premier, Jared Blay, said there is no safe illicit substance. That's why they're illegal. That's why the government is taking a zero tolerance approach to privately funded or publicly funded pill testing facilities. What's your response to this statement, and what outcomes would typically be seen for a zero tolerance stance?
It's absolutely fair to say that no drug is safe to use, and I think that all harm reduction and pill testing drug checking services would agree, and that is always the key message that's given to people who use these services. And there are definitely risks involved using illegal substances. There's also risks involved using legal substances like tobacco and alcohol and even some medicines, even when they're used as prescribed. We know that banning access to drugs, banning access to harm reduction services doesn't change people's behaviour. Drug use is a part of society. People have used drugs, whether they've been illegal or illegal, throughout time. What banning zero tolerance approaches tend to do is it removes access to health services and access to health professionals that can provide critical education and advice to people who might otherwise not be able to access that information in other places. So it removes opportunities for education about risk and or strategies people can take. And it also implies that people who do decide to take risks and use drugs don't deserve access to information because of their choices, which is problematic, and sort of removes some of the trust that young people or other people going to festivals might have in services and governments because they may not have experienced the risks that they hear about. The information that they're sort of receiving from a top-down approach isn't necessarily aligning with their experiences.
Rita Bryan, researcher and harm reduction specialist from the Pennington Institute, speaking with The Wire's Ella Panizzolo.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Experts from all sectors have delivered vital perspectives on two of the country's major concerns at this month's Health and Climate Forum. Spearheaded by peak advocacy body Doctors for the Environment Australia, the event came in the lead-up to the federal government's renewed emissions targets, welcoming local and international speakers to discuss policy reform and ways to tackle climate. To hear more, The Wire's Sam Giorgio was joined by Dr. Kate Wiley and Dr. Adivas from Doctors for the Environment Australia, along with Ruby Hamilton, special counsel in the WA practice at the Environmental Defender's Office.
What was the overall aim of the Health and Climate Forum this year, and what were some of the key messages you were looking to deliver?
So the fundamental aim of the Health and Climate Forum was to demonstrate how our health is impacted by climate change, obviously, and also our energy policy, our environment policy, and how we need to prepare health for the impacts of climate change. That was the first aim, which was basically diagnosing the problem about how health is impacted by climate. And then the second thing we did was offer things that people can do, because of course, every time you start talking about health or climate change more generally, it's a pretty hard thing to listen to. It's a pretty heavy topic. So the second day, we really focused on different ways people can make a difference in their personal and professional lives.
The conference came in the lead up to last week's emissions target. How do you feel about the government's target to cut emissions by 62 to 70% by 2035?
I think it's more than it was. It's more than 43%, but it's certainly not enough to protect health. The science was telling us that we needed to be 75% or more. And I think whenever you set a range, it's always a little bit scary. You think 62 to 70, then will we make 62? I would have liked to have seen our Prime Minister set a higher target, especially when the climate risk assessment came out earlier the week showing just how risky climate change is
This target was set under international law. It's an element of the framework established by the Paris Agreement. From a legal perspective, under international law, it will be really interesting to see the development of how these nationally determined contributions, as they're called under the Paris Agreement, are looked upon by international courts. And a target like this, we can probably expect to be scrutinised under international law for whether Australia really is meeting its international climate obligations.
How important is it now more than ever to frame climate change in a way that engages people who would otherwise not believe in it or actively fight against it?
I think putting a health frame onto climate personalises it. You know, when you start to say, okay, climate change is going to impact your health, your family's health, your elderly parents' health, the health of your cat and your dog and everything you see around you, then it becomes, as I said, a personalised problem rather than other problem, rather than something that's happening to people over there.
One thing that gives me hope or heartens me in all of this is actually there's segments of our populations and our professions, for example, where there's immense support. So New South Wales Health, for example, one of the largest health services in our country, a publicly operated system, has surveyed its staff and its patients. And I can give you some figures. So some 90%+ of patients have said they want the health service to do more. Doctors, nurses, allied health professionals, health managers, quality safety people, health researchers, the whole lot. Patients want more action on this. And you could say, is that a reasonable indication of the population? Perhaps. But also really empowering is the fact that staff wanted to. So something like 80%+ of staff in that particular year, a couple of years ago, when the survey was done. So this is not unusual.
What's the importance of doctors and lawyers and different professions pushing for climate reform compared to, say, just politicians or political actors?
We need to be all in. Like doctors, lawyers, everybody, though, has a responsibility, I think, to do what they can addressing what the World Health Organization calls the greatest public health threat facing humanity, which is climate change. Doctors, we have an ethical responsibility. We take an oath, and the first line of the oath is, I consecrate my life to the service of humanity. So how are we living under the oath if we are not doing something to address what is the greatest public health threat that we are all facing? And one of the things we really want to focus on is how fossil fuels are so dangerous to us.
When people say, doctors, stay in your lane, don't talk about the environment, how is it relevant? Our patients suffer from these environmental impacts. But it's not new. I mean, doctors have been advocating for so many socially relevant topics across the history of the profession. Why is this any different? It's not. In fact, it's even more relevant.
We can see right now across the world, places are slowly becoming uninhabitable and just under constant pressure from natural disasters like floods and heat waves. As a nation that's relatively wealthy, do we have a duty of care to support places like, say, Fiji, as you mentioned, and other places that are at risk?
You know, when did duty of care become such a this boogeyman concept? Certainly in the law, if it was enshrined, amazing. But actually, we have a social contract anyway in our countries where we expect government to act in the interest of its citizens. Similarly, as professionals, we have our own duty of care obligations. In some cases, like in medicine, it's made quite explicit and clear. But also, when you look at global health, which is an area of work that I do, and global health meaning working in international settings with partners in other countries, we already do that. So Fiji, for example, they're actually the ones leading on this at an international stage. So even that narrative where we say Australia has a duty of care to support its Pacific neighbourhood, sure, that's one way absolutely to look at it. But on the other hand, we have so much to learn because it was the High Ambition Coalition that came out of the Pacific Island countries that led to the 2015 Paris Agreement being enshrined. So these are super important places that are punching way above their weight. We like to think Australia punches above its weight, but actually our partners are right here with us. So I think we do need to pay more respect.
Australia has the second highest rate of climate cases in the world, which is pretty incredible considering the population, but it really reflects that level of anger and frustration that people have about the impacts of climate change that are being felt without action from governments and from the corporations that do have power and control over those outcomes. Ultimately, it really shouldn't be a case of having to drag governments and corporations kicking and screaming to international and domestic courts to enforce a duty of care.
The Wire's Sam Giorgio speaking with Dr. Kate Wiley and Dr. Adi Vass from Doctors for the Environment Australia, along with Ruby Hamilton, Special Counsel at the Environmental Defender's Office. Queensland is becoming more noticed with the approach of the 2032 Olympic Games. Queensland Minister for Multicultural Affairs, Fiona Simpson, says the voices of multicultural Queenslanders are gaining more importance and they've shaped how the state is seen internationally. In an exclusive interview, The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking Minister Simpson what's the best memory throughout her career in state politics.
I know that through my work and my advocacy, there are people who are alive today. If I hadn't advocated, they wouldn't be alive. And that is perhaps the most meaningful for me. As far as my formal roles, though, I'd say the role I have currently, I love it. I do have a background across quite diverse communities, particularly in the Asian space. I'm a language grad, a Japanese language grad, but to be able to be the Minister for Multiculturalism, I just love it. It's a great space to be in because it's about people.
Now, as you mentioned, you have a very long title, but you mentioned that you are Minister for Multicultural Affairs. How has multiculturalism changed or shaped Queensland's position since you were elected as an MP?
Multiculturalism, or the diversity of our history, actually goes back. We're all migrants, even our first peoples, that's a long time ago, but our first peoples, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander peoples, have been here 50, 60,000 years before the land bridge. But those who've come since, we all have a history somewhere of being migrants, even if it's back a few years. So Queensland, Cairns in the 1880s, a third of Cairns' population was Chinese. That'll surprise a lot of people. There was actually a Japanese consulate in Townsville back in the 1880s. So it's longer than what people realise, but obviously I think there's perhaps more diversity in that migrant story today. And I think also what we're seeing throughout our regions and throughout Queensland, where people bring their culture, but they're also bringing their expertise. It's become a lot more diverse, the regional workforce, because there are opportunities and there is great need. And I think we're seeing that right throughout our state.
Now, we're living in a time where there are groups protesting against multicultural communities, against migration. What's the state government's plan to reduce racism and discrimination in this sense?
I think it's really important we talk about how we build social cohesion. You already have laws against inciting hatred and violence. What we need to do is bring the conversation around what is social cohesion. And now this is a space that's across, it's not about left politics or right politics. There's a very dangerous piece in what I call the online disintegration of community, and with AI driving people's feeds to perhaps amplify certain messages. This is not about one side of politics or one ideology or another. It's quite a fractured space with what happens with the internet. So I think we have to have conversations around how we bring people into real community and connection, because the online space, it can be used for good or for evil, but unfortunately it amplifies the worst.
You're also the Minister for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Partnerships. We went to the Queensland Parliament and there was a part of the state budget that is funding for Closing the Gap's priorities. What are the priorities the community has mentioned to you they need support on?
Look, this is a fascinating, very necessary part. And there's a gap that's even bigger than what people see. And it's particularly in our rural and remote where those communities aren't seen as much. But the statistics of disadvantage, the more remote you go, are really substantial. So this fund is particularly focused on the areas of the greatest disadvantage, and that is the most rural and remote of our Indigenous communities. But there are places in Queensland that don't even have clean drinking water. That is a basic human right. Most of the world has clean drinking water. So, for example, that fund has, we've already announced funding programs for Woorabinda. That's been on boiled water alert since last year. But it's not only water projects, but it is about those closing the gap priorities with health, with education, with housing. We've got a housing program to roll out more housing. And now housing matters everywhere. I absolutely understand it's tight in our cities and our urban areas.
Last week, Victoria announced that it's the first jurisdiction to table a treaty bill in Australia. Is there a way Queensland can follow suit, or how do you see this?
Look, we have made clear that our focus is working particularly with our communities on their frontline needs and opportunities. And as I've moved around some of the most remote communities, I'll be really honest, some of them are actually a bit over the Closing the Gap programs because they've seen so much bureaucracy and so much attention to some of the things that aren't the frontline needs that they have. So I'm listening to these communities and saying, how do you want the genuine and frontline needs addressed, and none of them have actually mentioned the legislation that you've raised. Queensland had legislation, and they were saying to me, we want same opportunities for our children with education, with health, with housing. The water is just one of those clear areas that should have been addressed, but that hadn't been addressed previously. So the priority is on helping people bridge the gap with access to those services.
Queensland Minister for Multicultural Affairs, Fiona Simpson, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
Concern remains as South Australia's algae bloom crisis persists beyond initial forecasts, and communities are feeling the impacts, including younger generations. Research indicates 67% of Australian youth struggle with eco-anxiety, and SA's marine catastrophe is only worsening symptoms. Blue Minds is a national youth wellbeing initiative and will visit seven local schools to support children with eco-anxiety following the state's marine crisis. The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with Cal Glansnig, co-founder of Blue Minds and director and producer of documentary Rising Up.
It's really important to really try to spread a hopeful message because the future's unwritten and young people have such a big role to play to really look after themselves firstly, but how do young people really drive the change that our community and our country needs at the moment?
Why do you think particularly the youth of Australia are deeply concerned by the climate crisis?
I think it's the love that we have for our natural environment and for our planet. So this is something that young people are experiencing all across the world, but I think in Australia we're so uniquely tied to our ocean, to our own natural environment. So I think when we are seeing the impacts of climate change, not just in the future, but what we're experiencing now all over the country, it is really unsettling for a lot of young people.
In terms of more recent events, the algal bloom in South Australia has resulted in various negative impacts on our community. How have you seen this specifically affecting young people?
With the Blue Minds program, which is a partnership between Surface of Climate and the Good Human Factory, we've spent the last 12 months travelling all across the country. So we've delivered workshops to over 10,000 young people. And the biggest thing that we've realised in South Australia compared to any other place we've ever visited is just the amount of young people that are so concerned about the future of our planet. And we always ask at the start of our workshop who here loves the ocean. Everyone puts their hand up and then we say who's concerned about, you know, some of the different challenges that the ocean's going through. And compared to places like Perth or Sydney or Brisbane, yesterday afternoon we had about 90 to 95% of students put their hand up straight away, which just shows that eco-anxiety is so high and climate distress is so high here in South Australia at the moment, which has really been fueled by the algae bloom.
What is Blue Minds' initiative in terms of helping young Australians turn their worries and eco-anxieties into action and resilience?
Yeah, so we always have the mindset that hope lies in action. So as long as we're doing things that are within our control, we can feel a bit better because we are riding the future and using our actions to steer it in a different direction. My background, I've been travelling the world, spoken at the United Nations COPs a couple of times and have been on a journey to really try to find how young people can take action to look after our ocean and our climate in a positive way. And I joined forces with Surface for Climate and Cooper Chapman, who has a book releasing next Wednesday, actually is a very big speaker in the mental health space, has spoken to 50,000 students about practical mental health tools that are scientifically backed. So we came together last year reading all of the research around eco-anxiety and how that is a really big problem for a lot of young people. It says about 67% of young Australians' mental health's been impacted by fears about the future of our climate. So we came together and have been delivering free high school and university workshops the last 12 months to, over 10,000 students. And it's been incredible, the uptake. We've got around 95 schools on our wait list. So we're really trying to, work out how we can, reach as many young people as possible. And we're just on the road constantly, just really trying to spread a hopeful message of gratitude, of mindfulness and of positive ways to take action for our planet.
Clearly, Blue Minds relies on partnership with the local schools, councils and organisations. How important is this kind of community support in helping tackle eco-anxiety as well as the broader physical impact of the algal bloom?
Oh, it's incredibly important. I mean, it's like people who have young people in their lives to really look out for these signs of climate distress and, create those safe spaces for young people, but also empower them about how they can create change.
Cal Glansnig, co-founder of Blue Minds and director and producer of documentary Rising Up, speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya. Stay tuned for tomorrow's show brought to you from 4EB in Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can also hop online to check out our stories at The Wire. org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you tomorrow evening on The Wire.